Today I'm in Dalkeith with Chris Townsend, and I don't know when we last saw each other.
I was trying to think the same, because I can't actually remember if I've actually seen you since you became a reverend.
I'm not sure. Can you remember where we first met?
Yes, I can. It was 26 Newington Road in Edinburgh. Because way back in the summer of, now what would that be now? Summer of 93, I think. I met, who is now your husband, Ian, and his flatmate Tim, and moved in with them while I was studying social work at Edinburgh University. So I reckon at some point you came round and that was when I first met you. A lifetime ago, really, isn't it?
It does seem a lifetime ago. Did people that you knew then take on the flat?
That's right. It was one of those strange situations where people who knew somebody knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, and for years and years, people would just come in on that basis.
So the landlord did really well. He just put one ad in the Scotsman.
Yeah.
And originally, Ian phoned up and... and that was it. And then, what, 15 years later or something, the flat was still let to this group
of... to somebody, because the guy was a kilt maker, as you would probably remember. No, not a kilt maker, sporran. A sporran maker, I'm sorry. He lived just around the corner, and he wasn't really in it for the money, which was great for us who were renting it from him. But he would do what he needed to do. But yeah, so once Ian and Tim moved out, two others came in with me, and so it went on, really. I don't know the situation now, but I recently found out that not that long ago, somebody else I knew had been in that flat.
Do you drink tea?
Well, I think you can probably see that for the viewers at home, as my pastor sometimes says to people who are listening to audio, I'm drinking from a mug that says tea makes everything better. So I most certainly do. I am definitely a tea Jenny. I do drink coffee, but probably at the ratio of 5 cups of tea to 1 cup of coffee.
And what's your favourite cup of tea, either brand or time of day?
Yes, well, the first cup of tea in the morning is always good, but I tend to have it at work. I drink my juice here and then I go into work. But this cup of tea tonight on the end of a hot day is also rather nice, particularly as I'm sharing it with such good company, of course. A few years ago, well, no, it's a long time ago now. I keep saying a few years and realise that 20 years has passed. But I stopped drinking caffeinated drinks because it was making my heart race. So I went on to decaf. So my actual favourite decaffeinated kind of English type of tea is actually Typhoo. Has the best taste. But it's also quite expensive and not so easy to find these days. So my staple cup of tea now is Tesco Scottish Blend Decaf.
Oh, that's good, because we've had too many Yorkshire teas. I feel we've been overrepresented with Yorkshire teas on this podcast project. So, the statement, which I'm bringing to everybody.
Yeah.
How do you respond to the statement, Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping?
Well, obviously you gave me that question in advance, which I'm glad you did, because I'm not sure what I would say if you'd asked it to me absolutely live. I don't think it's either, personally. Obviously, you can hear a lot in the media, you can read a lot in the press, and certainly there are loads of statistics around, particularly from down south, as we call it up here, in your part of the world, in the Church of England, in particular, of the kind of established church, if you like, the state church declining. But you know as well as I do that that doesn't apply to every Church of England parish. Up here, probably a similar situation in Scotland with the established church, the Church of Scotland. I'm part of the smaller Episcopal Church, which is a branch of the Anglican Communion. I think I call it the Church of England in Scotland or something like that. And it's a similar kind of picture. There are churches in Edinburgh there that are full and very much still drawing people in, and there are others that aren't. But I think we need to look beyond church buildings and deeper than that, and to other places where faith is clearly very much alive for people, and getting worked out on a daily basis. And that includes the Christian charity, the Redwoods Caring Foundation that I work for, where we employ Christian staff for any of the caring roles. And the, you know, the Christian faith there is very, very much alive, praying on a daily basis, trying to outwork being Jesus to the people that we're supporting. So I don't think it's dying, and in a sense I don't think it's sleeping either. I don't think it's waiting to be kind of woken up. I think there's a process going on, and fortunately God is sovereign in all of this anyway. So he will decide by his Spirit when the actual end times are and when he's going to pour out his Spirit on all flesh, as the Bible tells us. So kind of look forward to that day. Yeah.
I mean, the statement isn't mine. It was in an article by Tim Stanley in the Daily Telegraph some time ago. But our own churches are contradictory in that Sunday mornings, I can't get people to come to church on Sunday mornings. I used to be able to, about 5 years ago, maybe six. Our Sunday morning attendances were growing up, but they've been, particularly one place they've been sliding, but we now have lots of other worship on other nights of the week, and which we weren't before, and lots of people coming to that or to the Sunday afternoon. So it's a bit contradictory for us, in that if we only count our Sunday mornings, it's definitely going down, but if we count all our other worship, it's going up or staying the same.
And I think that's part of it, isn't it? That question and people's views on that is, what are they actually looking at? Are they looking at the kind of roll call on a Sunday morning, or are they looking deeper? Because certainly in our church, and you know, my minister would say that the smaller group meetings that people take part in during the week are as important as the Sunday meeting. Sunday meeting should be a celebration of everything that's happened during the week in those smaller groups, where you get to know people more intimately, where you challenge each other and you help people grow in their faith and then come together, because you can't really do that on a Sunday, and I'm sure you know that better than most.
I mean, we have a really big home group in one of our churches, which has a lot of people, many of whom can't manage to come to church on a Sunday. And they're coming to this Thursday night home group. In fact, a while back, we started something called Thursday Night Live, which we hope would happen in church and would be a kind of equivalent. It didn't flourish, but the Thursday Night Home Group quite often have more people than used to come to that Thursday Night Live. So I'm like, well, obviously it was working, but it wasn't wasn't the right season for that to work in that context in the church building. So each person gets three specialist questions.
Do I not get to answer what my favourite T letter
later
is?
On.
I have to wait for that. Oh, okay, right. That's fine then.
Yeah.
I'll hold on.
It's
the
roundup question. Hold on. Yeah. Hold on okay. To that. What do you think are the best ways to help a friend who is grieving?
Yeah, now obviously I know why you're asking me that question. So if anybody listening to that, my late wife suffered from cancer for 3.5 years and died 2.5 years ago. And I guess that's kind of why you're asking. And I was trying to think of something, not clever is the wrong word, but I was trying to think, how can I sum that up in three words? If somebody was listening, thinking, what can I actually do to support somebody? And I came up with the three L's, which are love, listen, and leave. Because I think in that situation, people need loved. They need love through the initial bereavement, but they need that to be an ongoing thing. Certainly my experience has been that, and I understand it because it's life and we're all busy, but you know, the initial 4 to 6 weeks, people are around for you all the time, and sometimes too much when you actually do need support and space at the same time. And that's why I put my leave in there, because it's important at that time to come along, to be there, to listen, and then to go away and give that person some space. The difficulty is that maybe 6-10 weeks down the line that people don't often come back. And I think that's not a criticism of them as such. I think probably some people actually struggle to know what to talk about, because it's very easy in those early stages to know kind of what to talk about. How are you doing? How are you feeling? What can I do to help you? And then as time goes on and the person moves on, it's less obvious perhaps what to do. So love, not just for a few minutes, but keep loving. Listening, I suppose I'm probably as guilty as anybody of this in the past. In any situation that I have been invited into, to think that I might know what the answer is to that, having not experienced it myself. So one of these things I've kind of learnt is, until you've been through it, you really don't know. So yes, you can show a level of empathy, and of course you can be compassionate, but try to avoid giving advice. What the person really wants is just to be able to talk, to share, and really that's the best thing you can do, is listen. And I sort of touched on the leave. Again, it's particularly in those early days, people want to come around and support you, but you still need that little bit of space. And actually, it's very tiring, repeating conversations or answering the same kind of questions, even though, you know, the people coming are doing it from the best of intentions. So I would say don't ever stay more than an hour unless you're specifically asked to. Give that person some of the space and the recovery time that they need. That's my three kind of answers to that question. There's loads more I could probably go on and talk about, but I think I was trying to think, how can I sum this up? How can I make it kind of poignant and pointed so that people can think about that?
Oh, I think that's really good. Really good advice. I think, my dad, 6 weeks after my mum died, I mean, they weren't together for years and years, said, I guess you'll be over your mum's death by now. And it was one of those things which it showed he didn't really understand. But there are still people who think, well, that's it, there's a short period. But actually, it's not, not at all.
No, and it's different for different people, and people deal with things like grief in very, very different ways. So some people are much more open about it, some people are much more private. And I guess some people do try to just pretend it's not there, and then that doesn't give people a way in anyhow. But, you know, the whole time that Angie was ill, we talked about stuff, you know, particularly for my girls. We never hid anything from them. And that process continued as much as we could after a death, after a funeral. And we're in a good place now. They're always going to be missing their mum. And that's hard. I can't replace them. Nobody can replace the mum. But, you know, I try to be the best dad I can. And my new wife, Alice, has been absolutely brilliant with them. So they have a mother figure again, which is great. But I understand it's never going to be the same for them.
No. The next question is to do with your work. But it's also a question which I kind of ask some of the other people who are dealing with this on a daily basis. As a nation, what would be some of the things we could do which would improve the lives of those with learning disabilities?
Well, actually, this is probably the hardest question you asked me, even though that's my field, because it's easier to perhaps answer at a very local level, like the charity that I work for, you know, how we can improve things. But at a national level, it's much more difficult. I suppose it was a really good question. It helped me really think about it, and I reflected on a couple of things, Janet. And one of them is, I think we're already seeing something change, and that's at the grassroots, if you like, but the early years at school now, there's been that kind of culture shift. And I know there's a debate that's ongoing about integration of people with learning disabilities into the mainstream education versus specialist schooling. And I can see both sides of the argument. But my stepdaughter is autistic, and she's been mainschooled all her life. And if we have sufficient support in there for her and sufficient knowledge, that's the best place for her to be, because I believe it's preparing her, you know, for life going forward. Also seeing my stepson know what his sister kind of struggles with, get alongside an autistic boy in his class, particularly on the sports day, where he's just not sporty at all and would normally get shouted at and, you know, name called or whatever because he was too slow or not good at catching something or whatever. Just getting along, say, come on, it's okay. Just take your time, come with me. Really spoke volumes to me. So I think what we can do is continue that process. I think if we educate children at an early enough stage, that's going to pay dividends in the end. I kind of mentioned the autism thing. One of the statistics that I came across only a couple of weeks ago now when I was watching a little TED talk online was that only 15% of people with autism have employment. And again, there is a debate about whether all people who have autism actually have a learning disability. Or, as the young lady that was on that really spoke to me, actually, she said that she sees autistic people as just a different kind of normal, which I really love, because it's coming from somebody with autism. It's not something that we've said about somebody who's got autism. But I think employment issues are massive for people, and she was relating to the fact that as soon as you mention autism, people are like sort of backing off and don't want to know, rather than trying to find out, okay, so what are your skills? What are your abilities? How can we support you in that? And certainly in the charity that we work for, we encourage our staff and everybody that we meet to see the person and not the disability. And that's, again, that's something that has to get embedded into our culture, I guess. In Scotland, I have to say, we've been very fortunate. The Scottish Government have spent a lot of time researching into people with learning disabilities. So in the year 2000, they commissioned a project called The Same As You, which I guess now, in the context of the lady I was talking about, describing a different kind of normal, was quite a good title. And really just looking in to see what barriers there were for people with learning disabilities in society in general and what could be legislated to help them. And I think it was just a really good time to begin that debate. And in the last few years, they revisited that kind of programme. And we now have something that's called Keys to Life, which really is setting out a standard, if you like, or the rights that people with learning disabilities should have. But I'm not naive enough to think that it's just going to be legislation that's going to change that. And that's why I started by talking about it's about culture. It's about how does the general population view people with learning disability? And I would go as far to say, how does people in the general population view social care generally? Because it's all part of that. And I personally don't think that social care is valued highly enough. You know, I work in the voluntary sector, in the charity sector. And, you know, as a sector, we save government organisations millions of pounds a year with the work that we do. Often paid at a roughly 50% of what we might be paid if we were working for a local government. And yet, it's one of the areas that is facing cuts. And we understand that generally, you know, people are having to do more for less. But there's a certain point that's going to have to come, I believe. And I think even the last couple of days, there was some debate from the health service point of view, wasn't there, about whether or not people would be prepared to pay extra tax if it was kind of ring-fenced for health. Well, with the whole health and social care integration agenda right now, which I strongly believe in, even though, again, it's had its difficulties from the start, then I think this is something that we can hopefully debate a bit more and see if we can get some more resources in to support people going forward, yeah.
What sort of church would you like your children to inherit?
Do you know, with this question, Janet, I actually went and asked Bethan, who's 19, my eldest daughter, what would she like, first of all? And she started off by saying, you know, the kind of multimedia church where there's lively worship, where there's PowerPoints and videos and lights and all that kind of thing. But what she said at the end of that question is something that we've been talking about around our kitchen table quite a bit, as she has taken on part of the role at our church for leading the youth there. And during that time, she's been trying to help people discuss real life issues and the application of their faith to it. So that's certainly part of the answer, I think it's so important. Well, it's important for all of us, isn't it? We can not, you know, to have an application for our faith, to not be just be told what to do, but also to think about how we can do that and how we can support one another in it. But I think particularly for young people and for the youth, that's going to be really important. My answer would be summed up as spirit-filled and spirit-led. You know, I really believe that God sent his Holy Spirit to us. A pastor I know calls the Holy Spirit God in receivable form. It's who's around with us on a daily, day-to-day basis, you know, dwelling inside us. So, yes, spirit-filled, so the people coming are spirit-filled, and spirit-led, so that we're hopefully following as close to God's ways as we possibly can. And God does do this. People listening, you know, sometimes he just speaks to us at an appropriate time. And knowing that I had this interview with you coming up, I was just reading in the book of Micah in chapter 4, and I came across this verse which says that he will teach us his ways so we can walk in his paths. And I thought, do you know what? That's the answer to the question. What is the kind of church I would like for my children? It's a church that teaches them his ways and supports them to walk in his paths.
This is the roundup question. I didn't make that clear in the question this time.
No, you didn't. It kind of lasted at the end, you see. So I was all excited to share my tea.
So what is your favourite
tea? What is my favourite tea? Yeah, well, I could say Townsend, couldn't I? The Townsend family, because it's, you know, that's who we are. But it's Trains. It's Trains. I don't know how often you've had that answer.
I'm going to do a little graph at the end. Yes, who's okay. Choosing what?
So it'd be interesting to see, but I don't know why. I've always had an interest in Trains. I've got a train set which I've never been able to have out for years because there's no space to put it. But I've kept it. It's all kind of treasured there. I can still remember the first Christmas I got my first bit of track. And I got an engine from my mum and dad and two carriages from my nan and granddad. Can still remember the excitement just talking to you about it now and having that. But I love trains. I love travelling on them. I think they're quite therapeutic places to be when you can just look out the window, have time for yourself, have a wee snooze, read a book, take time away from the busyness of life generally. Not that I go on trains very often, but you can appreciate them more because I don't do that so often now. But just generally interested in stuff about the railways, particularly of late. Really love the series on Channel 5, which is Paddington 24/7, looking at the ins and outs of Paddington Station, and in fact the whole West Coast route, which obviously takes it down your way as well, through all the signalling and difficulties with flooding and all the things that they've had in that area. So
we have a very special tunnel so in our patch. So yes. Well, thank you very much for seeing me today, Chris. It's been lovely to see you.
And you. Thank you so much.